Our reading today is a single verse, verse 6 from Proverbs 22. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Hear what the Spirit is saying.
Rob Telled and E.J. Paley grew up in Washington, D.C. and at Foundry Church. As a young adult, she returned to her family's native home of Liberia, where she became a special assistant for communication to Liberia's President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. She has served as a columnist for New Narratives, a media development initiative. She served as an assistant editor for the Washington Informer newspaper, an editorial writer for Fahama Trust News. Rob Telled is the author of a children's book about Liberia that was published in 2013. Her writing has appeared in publications such as Sea Breeze Journal of Contemporary Liberian Writing, the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, The Guardian, New Africa Magazine, Africa Today, and AllAfrica.com. She has been recognized as a 2013 99 under 33 influential foreign policy leader. She was a 2010 Archbishop Tutu Leadership Fellow, a U.S. Today All-College Academic Team Finalist, and a 2003 Amnesty International Human Rights Fellow. She's a graduate of Howard University and Oxford University. She is currently a Mo Ibrahim Foundation PhD scholar at the University of London's School of Oriental and African Studies. We are very, very proud of Rob Telled as a daughter of Foundry Church. I want to say a welcome to some special people who are here this morning. One is Rob Telled's mother and her sister Ella. Would you please stand? Please welcome. You know these folk. Please welcome them. And I also want to welcome Reed and Tammy Kramer, who attended Foundry for a number of years while they were here in Washington, D.C. They are the founders and directors of AllAfrica.com, which has been the leading global source of information about Africa. Reed and Tammy, would you please stand up? And then the pastor of Foundry Church during many of Rob Telled's growing up years was Phil Waugaman. Phil and Carolyn Waugaman are here. And I'm going to ask Phil at the end of the service, Phil, if you'd come. Yes, stand up. People want to applaud you. Please stand up. And then, Phil, I'm going to ask you at the end of the service if you'd come up and do a closing prayer and benediction, if you remember how to do that. This is a real honor to have Rob Telled here. We're going to sing together a hymn, My Hope is Built on Nothing Less. And then the next voice you will hear after the hymn is Rob Telled, Nijay Paley. So let's rise and let's sing with all our heart, My Hope is Built.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Oh, I just got chills hearing that. It feels so awesome to be back at Foundry. This is truly a homecoming. I'd like to thank Reverend Snyder for the invitation to share the message today. Now, my father wanted to be here, but he's all the way in Liberia. But I know that he's here in spirit. And you just actually sang his favorite hymnal, so I can feel his presence. I'd like to just say a word of thanks for the new members who just joined Foundry and those who've had their children baptized, you couldn't have come to a better church. Please pray with me. May the words of my mouth, dear Lord, and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. My first memory of Foundry is vivid. I was 6 and had recently arrived from Liberia. With knots in my stomach, I walked with my father to Foundry's entrance. The 10-minute trek from our apartment building on 17th Street seemed to stretch out for miles on end. My skinny legs buckled. My dad was patient. He slowed whenever I slowed, all the while trying to engage me in a conversation that I was not prepared to have. When we arrived at the church building, I was paralyzed with fear. I hadn't had much interaction with American children, so naturally I was terrified. I eventually made it up the stairs to the first grade Sunday school class, poked my head in hesitantly, saw a slim woman who became Auntie Faye to me, as she has to many of our young people, and noticed children sitting in small chairs. What encouraged me to actually enter the room that day, albeit slowly, was a feeling of serenity and complete calmness. When I think about the 12 years I spent at Foundry, other defining moments come to mind. I remember having graham crackers and orange juice at the end of Sunday school. You guys remember that, right? And running on the lush green carpet in Fellowship Hall after services. During confirmation, I received my very first Bible with my name engraved in gold in flourishing letters. I remember the first time I donned an acolyte robe and how thrilling and humbling it felt being a part of the processional down the center aisle of the congregation. I remember coming to lock-ins on Friday nights when the church was empty and quiet and feeling the presence of God in that stillness. I remember going on retreats in remote areas of Virginia and Maryland, staying up all night talking and cementing bonds of friendship. I remember learning about religious tolerance while participating in a Jewish Seder service. I remember choir practices after church with Mrs. Prince, who always said, "Ladies, sing!" Because we all were all women. And the numerous times we performed at the White House, what an honor. I remember being enveloped in the misty Appalachian Mountains during the Appalachian Service Project, ASP, 4 consecutive summers in a row, learning how to hammer a nail in the wall and failing on so many occasions, and bawling like a baby during our emotionally packed end-of-week reflections. As a young person at Foundry, I learned that faith without works is dead. That if you can't help someone, then don't hurt them. And that every action, every single action, should be a prayer. In childhood and young adulthood, Foundry was my village. It was my oyster. It helped mold me into the person I am today, and it's been virtually impossible. And when I say virtually impossible, I mean virtually impossible to depart from that training, even when I wanted to. You see, Foundry invests in its children and youth, and there's a good reason for this. There are countless, countless references to children in the Bible, and when I was reflecting on what sort of message I would share with you today, I thought about something that would be wholly personal, but also something that would resonate with the entire congregation. And there's nothing more that resonates than speaking about what it means to be a child in the body of Christ. Now, some of us, myself included, are still children at heart. And we are still struggling to try to figure out what we want to be when we grow up. But according to Psalms 127, verse 3, children are a gift from God. Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 7 says, "Hear, O Israel, The Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, and with all thy soul, with all thy might. And these words, which I command thee this day, shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 4 says, Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy mother and thy father, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And Proverbs 22:6, which is the topic of this message today, says that we should train up a child in the way he or she should go, and when he or she is old, he or she will not depart from it. Now, these scripture lessons remind us that we have a responsibility to ensure that the Word of God is a mainstay in the children in our lives. If we diligently train our children in the way, they will remain true to that way and grow up to espouse Christian values, even when they don't realize they're doing it. And if they stray from these values, which they may do at times, they will return to what they know to be true and right, just as the prodigal son did. To train our children in the way means to train them to be Christ-like in both their words and their deeds. Now, when I was growing up, we had wristbands, t-shirts, bumper stickers, and the like with the letters WWJD. I think some of you remember that. What would Jesus do? They were a constant reminder of who we aspire to be like. They came in all colors, shapes, and sizes. They were cool because Jesus was cool. He still is. Kids who didn't even know who Jesus was were wearing the WWJD paraphernalia. Back then, the world seemed so much simpler and safer, when being Christian and professing your faith out loud wasn't considered weird or extreme. But the WWJD craze died down after the commercial sector moved on to the next fad. For many of us, though, Christianity wasn't cosmetic or trendy. Rather, it was and is something that enriched our lives very deeply. The trick to training children in the way in our contemporary setting is to make Christ and the Word of God more than just a passing fancy, more than just a trend or a fad, more than just a Sunday affair. In today's world of Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, we are constantly bombarded by external stimuli, both good and bad. It's made our attention span shorter, and we don't spend enough time on human interaction, on fellowship, on communion with the Spirit. In the midst of all the activity, it is important for primary caregivers, mentors, aunts and uncles, cousins, the church, to carve out spaces for relative inactivity in which children have time to be still, to reflect, to meditate, to pray, and listen to the Word. Being part of a church such as Foundry helps to distill what's important and what's not. Training a child in the way means coaching him or her to have a deep and abiding faith for others. Adults who have a healthy balance between what I call selflessness and self-preservation were children who were trained in the way. Now, when I was growing up, my working-class parents provided shelter for newly arrived immigrants from Liberia. In fact, our modest two-bedroom house apartment had a revolving door. Various aunts and uncles passed through. Sometimes they stayed a few months. Sometimes they stayed a little bit longer. Mom and Dad fed them, provided guidance about work opportunities in the U.S., all the while never asking for a penny. Now, I have to admit that I was often resentful of these housemates, some of whom stayed longer than they're welcome, because they were often given my room to use. I would pray in secret that they would find a home of their own quickly so that I could have my room back. Sometimes my prayers came true, sometimes they didn't. But it didn't occur to me until much later in my early adulthood that I realized my parents were training me and my younger sister Ella in the way of compassion. What mom and dad were saying, without ever uttering a word, is that when you're in a position to assist and help someone, you do it. No questions asked. Training children in the way also means carving out a safe space for them to question conventional wisdom, even if that wisdom happens to be in the Bible itself. In order for the Bible to remain relevant to children beyond their childhood or adolescence, it must speak to their everyday lived realities. Because the ability to question and probe while still arriving at the fundamental conclusion that Jesus is the light and the way makes one spiritual journey much more meaningful and worthwhile. For me, Foundry became a place where I felt wholly and utterly comfortable in my own skin, while also being challenged to question everything that I believed in to be true. While most child development is based on the combination of internal factors, such as temperament and genetics, and external factors, such as social influences, moral development is based solely on external forces. Now, children's immediate environment, their experiences at home, at school, and their social, cognitive, and emotional skills determine their sense of morality. It is at 5 to 7 years of age that children begin to internalize the value systems and social norms of the adults around them. We have such a responsibility. This is effectively when the moral compass of a child is established, where behavior is often determined by rules inherited from the family, from the church, and from schools. This is also the stage at which children learn the golden rule and become aware of the feelings and viewpoints of others. Children at this stage also expect direction from adults and begin to understand the consequences of their actions. At this stage, primary caregivers such as parents, as well as secondary source institutions such as churches and schools, become vital in reinforcing these values. The messages that children receive at this stage must be coherent and consistent. Children 7 to 10 years of age begin to question whether or not the adults around them know it all. Although they may still obey authority, they have most respect for adults who are fair and take charge. They understand the importance of rules, but also want to participate in rule making. It is at this stage that religious principles in the Bible can be most useful, enabling children to negotiate which norms are most meaningful to them. Parents can use this stage to drive home principles of justice and equality. Now, preteens and teens are in a class of their own, as we all know. At this stage, young people are caught in a vortex of constant negotiation, where peer values, family values, religious values, and social norms may or may not always align. Teens are capable of more abstract reasoning and may tinker with a number of value systems in search of the ones that are most appealing. Parents, oh dear parents, can act as advisors, but they rarely have the same kind of authority as they did in the past. This is where training in the way is put to the test. Now, if a young adult can move through the angst of adolescence relatively unscathed, it will be difficult for them to depart from their initial training. This is why ASP, the Appalachia Service Project, came at such a great time, because it enabled the young adults at Foundry to channel all that teenage angst into something productive and meaningful. Many of us came from relative privilege, and to be catapulted into relative deprivation was sobering and humbling. I often say that it was my time at ASP that prepared me to return to Liberia, where the contrast between wealth and want is so stark. Now, development psychologists have indirectly said a lot about training a child in the way without directly referencing the Proverbs passage. Skinner, a behaviorist, said that children could develop a moral compass through socialization. Unlike Freud, who believed that there was constant tension between internal and external forces on a person's development, Skinner focused almost entirely on external forces, such as parents, teachers, and religious institutions, as having the most important impact on a child's development. Building on Skinner, Piaget believed that in order to understand an adult's construction of morality, one had to look at his or her childhood. According to Piaget, children 5 to 10 years old believe that authority figures, such as parents and teachers, have rules that should be followed without question. Now, Kohlberg built on Piaget's work to establish 6 stages of moral understanding. He believed that children are motivated by punishment and obedience. They follow rules because they do not want to get into trouble. As children get older and develop more abstract and moral reasoning, they begin to see rules as unfixed and situational, applying these rules to their everyday lived realities. Kohlberg's model was often critiqued for being too male-centered and Western-centric, prompting other theorists, such as Turiel, to come up with more general concepts of moral development that could be applied cross-culturally. According to Turiel, individuals learn to distinguish between moral values and social norms from early childhood to adulthood. Unlike past theorists, Turiel believed that children as young as two, could develop moral standards. It is clear that there is a range of competing theories about childhood and development. What remains constant, however, is a belief that external forces such as parents, teachers, and the church play an important role. Effectively, morality is shaped through observation and imitation. The success of a child being trained in the way is determined by how well his or her external forces show and tell morality. Now, I didn't realize that I had been, quote-unquote, trained in the way until I moved to Liberia in 2007. Now, although I had always remained connected to the country of my birth while living in the U.S., that metaphysical connection did not prepare me for the challenges that I encountered. There were infrastructural problems such as the lack of running water or electricity for the vast majority of Liberia's citizens. But what struck me as the most difficult challenge was building up a value system that had been completely and utterly destroyed by our 14-year civil war. My being trained in the way quickly set me apart. I taught part-time at the University of Liberia, and some of the students called me difficult because I graded according to merit and refused to take bribes, no matter how small or how large. Working in the president's office, I was called inflexible because I looked for every opportunity to set up airtight systems and procedures. And a Liberian mentor of mine, who now works for the UN in New York, called me up and said people were complaining to him that I was too straight because I insisted that those who were with or without power must follow the same rules. Now, when a Liberian calls you inflexible, too straight, or difficult, it means you're doing something right. In post-conflict settings like Liberia, there's often a blurred line between fair and foul, because effectively, the moral order completely gets inverted. It is only during times of peace that it's possible to steer the moral compass of a nation, but that requires conviction and commitment from a critical mass of people. In Liberia, I discovered that corruption was systemic and entrenched, a function of both poverty and greed. I realized early on that training children in the way would require some unconventional methods. So in 2013, I wrote an anti-corruption children's book for 8 to 10-year-olds entitled Bagba, effectively to start a national conversation with kids about accountability to oneself, to one's community, and to one's nation. Bagba, which means trickery in my mother's native language, Bassa, has enabled me to begin planting the seeds of literacy and integrity, one child at a time, in Liberia. During a tour of Bagba in Monrovia, Liberia's capital, I discovered how astute young children were. One young girl told me, "Corruption is breaking the Ten Commandments and hurting people." I was absolutely shocked. This young child understood so fundamentally the intrinsic value of integrity. This is why I wrote Bagba, to give young children the verbal tools to question the confusing ethical codes of the adults around them. Because sometimes we do give children mixed messages. The fact of the matter is, children are honest until we teach them not to be. A Liberian radio personality once told me a funny story. Now, you've probably heard it in the US context, but I'll tell you the story in the Liberian context. A child is at home, and his mother is in the bedroom. The child hears a loud banging on the door and answers it. It is Auntie so-and-so, because in respect and deference to others, to elders, we call aunt, an older woman aunt, and an older man uncle. The aunt says she wants to speak to the mother and wonders if she's home. The child asks the aunt to wait a second, goes to the mother's room, and explains that Auntie so-and-so is at the door. Now, the child knows intuitively this is an aunt that the mother doesn't particularly care for. The mother tells the child to tell the aunt she is not in. The child nods, winks at the mother, walks back to the door, and without the slightest bit of irony, the child opens the door again and says, whispering to the aunt, enunciating each word emphatically, "My mother says I should tell you that she is not in." The moral of the story is, when we train children in the way, the onus is on us to lead by example. If we say we want compassionate children, we must be compassionate adults. If we say we want honest children, we must be willing to be honest at all times, even if it means seeing someone that we would rather not. If we say we want children who are just and fair, we must be fair and just without fear or favor. If we say we want children who do not depart from the values we have taught them, we must be willing to surround them within a community of believers, such as Foundry, so that those messages are consistent and coherent. It's not enough to simply train children in the way. The way must be a way of life for us all. Now, I often think of children as humanity's conscience. When I look into the eyes of my 4-year-old niece, who is as precocious as ever, or the face of my 8-year-old nephew, I am reminded that I have a responsibility to them. That it takes a village to raise a child. Children effectively remind us of why we need to do more to fight for a better universe. When we train children in the way, we are joining forces with them to create a future of endless possibilities. Now, I used to think that the best give a parent could give a child was a debt-free education. Now, I see some of you nodding because you're probably still paying off them student loans. Now, while a debt-free education is incredibly important in today's economy, I've come to realize that it's simply not enough. In a world that too often privileges money, power, and influence, the best gift a parent can give his or her child is moral discernment and the ability to live in the world without being consumed by its excesses. African-American intellectual Cornel West once said that an activist is someone who is maladjusted to injustice. Now, for me, a child who is trained in the way undoubtedly grows to become maladjusted to the vices of the world, while also striving so hard to change the world for the better. Now, Foundry's motto is, love God, love each other, change the world. I think that is such a powerful message. 26 years ago, Foundry embraced and welcomed a Liberian girl with skinny legs and a funny accent. Today, I am so grateful, so humbled for the training that I received here. Thank you.